This is the Genetics in Your World podcast by the Genetic Society of America, where we delve into the latest genetics research featuring highlighted content from GSA journals. This is your host, Joanna Wardwell Osgo, an assistant professor at Kennesaw State University in the Department of Molecular and Cellular Biology. Today, we will be discussing the recent publication, Dicentric Chromosome Breakage in Drosophila melanogaster is influenced by paracentric heterochromatin and occurs in non-conserved hotspots, published in Genetics by Hunter Hill, a graduate student in Kent Golick's lab at the University of Utah and his colleagues. This paper used a novel Drosophila tool developed by the Golick lab to characterize chromosome breakage points. They discovered that the different DNA compositions resulted in different chromosomal breakage points and suggest that these differences could be accountable because of differing centromere strength. Welcome, Hunter. To get us started, would you mind telling us a little about your scientific journey?
Hi, and thanks for having me on the podcast. It's an honor to be here. So my interest in science began when I was fairly young. My mom loves remembering this story. So around the time I was 10, I was watching Harry Potter and became really interested in the potions class. So I decided that I wanted to be a potions master. Well, after learning that wasn't really an option, I settled for the next closest thing, which my mom told me was a chemist. But I pronounce it chemicist. So for a while I wanted to be a chemicist. That then developed into a love of biology because my family spent a lot of time in the summers sailing off of the Oregon coast where I grew up. I was mesmerized by the large ocean animals, especially the humpback and orca whales. And one day at the Newport Aquarium, my sister Phoebe and I decided that we were going to be marine biologists. At the time, we thought it would be a great career. But as I aged, I was drawn towards medicine, primarily because we had several family friends that worked in the medical field, and they were role models for me. So when I graduated high school, I was set on being an emergency room doctor, which brought me from Oregon to Salt Lake City, Utah in 2011, where I completed my Bachelor of Science in Biology by 2016. During that time, I took genetics from a professor who had soon become my scientific mentor, Dr. Kent Golick. And his genetics class was extremely challenging, but also very rewarding. I was able to dig into problem-solving aspects of genetics and loved how no amount of memorizing would work in his class. I felt that he truly taught us how to think. So I did well in his course and soon found a home in the Golick lab, learning genetics with Drosophila melanogaster and working on projects that were fascinating, involving DNA damage and telomere healing, which we might talk about later. So at the end of undergrad, I took the MCAT and was not totally satisfied with my score. And one day while studying, Kent said something like, "You know, you can get paid to go to grad school and keep doing science." Mm-hmm. And that kind of flipped the switch for me to see what I really loved was the science and the problem solving associated with it. So then I applied to graduate schools and eventually made the tough decision to stay in Salt Lake City for graduate school and specifically to stay in Dr. Golick's lab because I felt that I had some unfinished work to do. So I received my PhD in April of last year and have remained in the Golick lab, finishing writing that we'll talk about today and continuing to work on fun projects while deciding what my next step's going to be.
Awesome. Congratulations, Dr. Hill.
Thank you.
Does it feel weird to be called Dr. Hill sometimes?
Yes. My thesis committee, I see in the halls and they'll wave at me and say, "Hello, Dr. Hill." And I chuckle because it's still kind of new to me.
What a great story on how you really got into science. I too, for some reason, well, I know why, wanted to be a marine biologist. I was born and raised in San Antonio, Texas, and they had a SeaWorld there. And so that's where I would go, you know, every once in a while. And I was also fascinated by those giant, beautiful sea creatures. So let's delve into a little bit of your science. The paper that you published in Genetics deals with breakpoints in chromosomes, which happens in flies and also in humans. What is the biological consequence of these breakpoints in human disease?
Well, chromosome breakage by itself is not necessarily a bad thing. Normally, when chromosomes break, there are DNA damage checkpoints that stop the cell cycle to repair the damage. There are multiple ways to repair the damage. Oftentimes, the cell will use what's called homologous recombination to repair a double-strand break seamlessly. It copies the DNA sequence from a homologous chromosome and stitches the break back together perfectly with the same number of base pairs as there were before the damage. The cell can go on then to live happily. However, if a homologous DNA sequence is unavailable, the cell will do what is called non-homologous end joining, and that puts the two ends back together, but will often be accompanied by insertions or deletions of base pairs. This can be mutagenic. And then finally, if there are multiple breaks in the nucleus at once, non-homologous end joining can put together breakpoints that were never together. For instance, it can connect two different chromosomes. We call these genome rearrangements or translocations, and they're very important for understanding both human disease and evolution. A vast majority of cancers have genome rearrangements and continue to acquire more of them throughout their existence within a single individual or even a tumor.
Really cool. So do these breakpoints occur during human development?
Yes. Chromosome double-stranded breaks certainly happen throughout human development. During meiosis, in cells that become sperm and eggs, the chromosomes are damaged on purpose to be a site of homologous recombination. This is how our chromosomes from mom and dad become mixed up so that not all of our children look the same. And then some carcinogens can also cause DNA damage, either directly or indirectly. In this paper, we specifically looked at dicentric chromosome breakage, which causes a unique type of DNA damage because the cell is only left with one side or half of the break and thus cannot do homologous recombination to repair it. Dicentrics are simply chromosomes with two centromeres. And centromeres are the points of attachment where the microtubules hook up to move the chromosomes around during cell division. Actually, there is another protein complex in there called the kinetochore, but for today, we'll refer to the attachment site as a centromere. And when two centromeres of the dicentric chromosome segregate to opposite poles during division, the chromosome between them can become stretched and break, leaving each daughter cell with half of a broken chromosome. This can be especially detrimental because dicentric breakage can then perpetuate more DNA damage in every subsequent cell cycle if the broken end then replicates and fuses with its sister after replication. Another dicentric is formed. These are called bridge breakage fusion cycles and can ultimately result in large chromosome duplications and deletions. But yes, dicentric chromosomes can be formed naturally and can occur during human development as well as in cancers.
Interesting. So really deleterious in both aspects.
Yeah.
So I also study Drosophila. What makes Drosophila such a good tool to examine this work? Is this how Drosophila balancers were made, this like process of breaking apart the chromosomes?
Yes, absolutely. So balancers are multiply inverted chromosomes, and that's a type of genome rearrangement that occurs with often non-homologous end joining, just like we were talking about. So yes, that's one great tool that we have in Drosophila, our balancer chromosomes. For this work, I think a couple different pieces are really important from Drosophila. One of them is the fact that chromosome structure is really very consistent across eukaryotes. So eukaryotes typically have linear chromosomes with a centromere and two telomeres. The telomeres are the caps at the end of the chromosome, and the centromere, as we talked about, are the sites where they can be attached to move around the cell. So what we learned from studying fly chromosomes often holds true for human chromosomes. And except for that, flies only have four pairs of chromosomes when humans have 23. So they're a little bit easier to keep track of under the microscope. Another thing is that the tissue dissection and cytology is really straightforward in flies. So examining the cells and chromosomes on the microscope is generally doable all in the same day. And then I actually mapped these breakpoints using polytene chromosomes, which involves staining these really large chromosomes that exist in the salivary glands to look at under the microscope. And that's really only possible in Drosophila because these polyteen chromosomes have been studied and mapped for almost 90 years in this organism. I should mention that breakpoint mapping can now be done at higher resolution and in other organisms with DNA sequencing. And we are actually collaborating with the FADNIS lab here at the University of Utah to do just that.
Wow, that's really awesome. So this story utilized a tool that you developed in the Gollick lab. Can you explain how this tool works?
Sure. Well, in this paper, we combine several tools that have been established in melanogaster for our germline dicentric screen. But there are a couple of essential pieces that we put together for the first time. One was the use of circular or ring chromosomes. These actually exist without telomeres. And as you can imagine, they're circular. So it's just like the linear chromosome had its ends stuck together. And in the past, studies of dicentric chromosomes mostly just involved linear chromosomes. And the methods by which those dicentrics are made generates a chromosome fragment without a centromere or an acentric fragment, which can then be lost or left out of the nucleus because it doesn't have a centromere. So this ends up leaving the daughter cells without a full genome, a term we call aneuploid. And since those cells eventually die due to the deficiency, it's difficult to design an experiment where we can map the breakpoints of the dicentric chromosome. So our new system generates dicentric chromosomes by inducing recombination between sister ring X chromosomes, which brings us to the other essential tool for this work, the FLIP recombinase. This is a site-specific DNA recombinase that was discovered in yeast and brought into flies by Dr. Gollick around 35 years ago. So this tool gives us specific control over when and where recombination happens. So each ring chromosome we use has a specific DNA sequence called a FLIP recognition target, or FRT. And that is, as you guessed it, recognized by the FLIP recombinase. So when FLIP is expressed, it locates two FRTs and induces recombination between them. When this happens in a circular chromosome, the two sisters actually become connected and it generates a double dicentric bridge without any acentric fragment. This allows us to recover a complete chromosome after dicentric breakage, and there's no loss of that acentric fragment. So that's kind of really the new technology here.
Capturing everything there instead of losing genetic information.
Yeah, exactly. And then the FRTs that we use are located in the same euchromatic location in each ring X chromosome. So euchromatin is what we think of as open and active chromatin. This is where the majority of protein coding genes are. In contrast, heterochromatin is tightly compacted and there's not many genes there. It houses the structural parts of the chromosome like the telomeres and centromeres. In Drosophila melanogaster, about a third of the genome is heterochromatin. But ultimately, these chromatin states are defined by histone modifications and specific proteins.
Thanks for introducing us to heterochromatin and euchromatin. So one of the interesting things that really struck me about your paper was that you found a preferential breakage point between euchromatin and heterochromatin. Why do you think there was a preference for breaks in the euchromatin instead of heterochromatin, which you would think because it's active and open, it might break easier? Why were the breaks? What do you think the breaks were kind of more the compact chromatin that's not necessarily being actively transcribed?
Yeah, so initially we expected a vast majority or all of the breaks to actually occur in heterochromatin simply because of the gene density. So if breaks had an equal probability of occurring anywhere along the dicentric bridge, then those with breaks in heterochromatin would have the least likelihood of hurting vital genes or generating lethal duplications and deletions. Since we recovered these linearized X chromosomes in living animals, there's a strict requirement for the chromosome to be viable as the only X in males. So as for the preference in euchromatin versus heterochromatin, that really had us stumped because we thought they were all going to occur in heterochromatin, and instead over half of them occur in euchromatin. So this got us thinking about these sites of human chromosomes called common fragile sites. And these are, as you can imagine, sites that are prone to chromosome breakage and that they are fragile. They're known to be late replicating and home to large genes, like hundreds of kilobases. So we spent some time in this paper working to compare these common fragile sites with our dicentric breakage hotspots and became a little bit stuck. But one thing we do know is that two of the breakage hotspots in euchromatin have really large genes for flies, and they are in late replicating regions. So it's possible that R loops or conflicts between transcription and replication machinery are actually causing some of the double-stranded breaks that we recover in our dicentric screen. This would explain some of the preference for euchromatin sites over heterochromatin.
And that conflict really is that as replication is beginning, there's still some active transcription going on, and those mechanisms and mechanics and protein units kind of bump each other off and you can get a break there.
Yeah, it's you can actually have collisions between the machinery. And then if you have stalled replication forks, which can occur because of those collisions, then as the cell tries to kind of reconcile that, a double-stranded break is usually induced with the hopes that it's going to be able to fix it right away. But that doesn't always happen. So especially if we're pulling on it in the sense of a dicentric chromosome, that may not be able to be repaired properly.
Interesting. So some of your breakpoints, like division 18 that you reported on, are in a region that does not show late replication, which is unlike some of these other breakage points that we were just talking about. Do you think this evidence points to the possibility that breakpoints can have multiple different biological mechanisms that underlie them?
Yes, absolutely. I think this is a great question. So I believe the hypothesis that we pursued are not mutually exclusive. The breakage hotspot that you mentioned, number 18, falls almost directly in the middle of the dicentric bridge, and the others do not. So it's possible that this site becomes broken actually due to its location in the middle of the bridge. So in some organisms, like in yeast, cytokinesis is required to cleave dicentric bridges. And it's thought that it's actually the force from the contractile ring that is breaking the DNA. But this is occurring in Drosophila germline cells, and they don't actually undergo complete cytokinesis. So it's unlikely to be direct force provided by the contractile ring in this case, and it may be something indirect like endonuclease cleavage. So it's possible that endonucleases are still using the cleavage furrow to then localize at the center of the bridge to resolve this issue during cell division.
Interesting. What was the most surprising result from all of your research?
For me, I think the most surprising after finding those breaks in euchromatin was probably when we looked at three different ring X chromosomes, and each ring was found to break in different locations and in different frequencies. So that was pretty crazy for me. And being able to then verify those findings under the microscope by quantifying the breakage in somatic cells was extremely satisfying. So seeing those two experiments validating each other just felt really good. So this finding also then gave me another avenue to turn down when we were getting negative results as we tried to explain some of the euchromatic hotspots. And in turn, it allowed me to discover some other really interesting biology that has to do with centromere size and strength. So the ring breakage frequency correlates well with the quantity of paracentric heterochromatin. So this is heterochromatin around the centromere. We don't think this is a coincidence. Instead, we think the rings with more paracentric heterochromatin actually have larger centromeres and are able to build larger kinetic cores, which can then attach more microtubules, resulting in a larger pulling force that can break the DNA. Further evidence supporting this hypothesis comes from the ring X with least amount of heterochromatin. This breaks the least frequently. And when we look at those bridges under the microscope, we can see that they're sometimes disconnected from the spindle poles and remain kind of in the middle near the metaphase plate. We call this lagging. And while the rest of the chromosomes segregate normally. So we attribute this to it having the smaller centromere and therefore experiencing the less pulling force during dicentric stretching.
And would these lagging chromatin pieces of DNA, would that cause aneuploidy in those cells?
Certainly. Yeah, I think that that chromosome is not actually probably ever going to make it into either of those daughter cells. And since it's a double dicentric bridge, it's the whole X chromosome is involved in that bridge. So those cells will not receive an X chromosome.
Interesting. So you noted on this a little bit in your answer to the prior question, but it really did seem like many of the hypotheses that you tested trying to figure out this biology were negative, which can be extremely frustrating to do, especially when you're in your PhD. How did you persevere during these obstacles? And do you have any advice for anybody facing similar setbacks?
That's true. The negative results were extremely frustrating when we're trying to uncover the mechanism underlying those euchromatic hotspots. And I remember actually thinking a few years ago, are we ever going to figure this out? And at that time, Dr. Golic's support was really paramount. He never really worried about it. And if we tested hypotheses and they wouldn't fit, he just kept helping me come up with more ideas and was extremely supportive. But then again, there was enough cool biology happening with my work that I was able to kind of not let it get me down and turn the other way and follow another finding when I was frustrated. And that's how I sort of dove into the centromere strength stuff. So we really don't have it all completely figured out, but I think we're heading in the right direction with understanding this system. And then as for advice, I would say keep communication open with your mentor and take breaks when times are hard. If you feel like you're banging your head against the wall, either ask for some help or give it a rest. Work on something else because eventually more ideas will come. We're scientists. We kind of are always thinking about this stuff. So don't try to overthink it.
That's great advice. Don't overthink it. Take a break. Really, really key things to kind of keep in the back of your mind. So what is one of the hypotheses that are kind of brewing your head to try to explain this biology that you're most excited for the lab to test following up on your studies?
Yeah, I think I'm most excited about the work that I've been doing right up until the very last minute here. We've had a hard time giving up on the idea that late replication may be underlying some of the fragile sites. And our most recent work has been focused on examining this hypothesis by creating a replication fork barrier to see if this will generate a fragile site. So to do this, we're using pieces from the lac operon taken directly from E. coli. So we brought a tandem array of the operator DNA sequences onto our ring X chromosome in several locations that were not previous breakage hotspots. And we plan to express now the lac repressor during dicentric formation in the male germline to see if this protein DNA interaction generates a fragile site that we can recover through our screen. This has been shown to work as a replication fork barrier in yeast. And some of our early experiments here under the microscope are looking really promising. So I'm excited to see what happens there. It should be really cool.
That sounds so incredibly cool. As somebody who doesn't think or study chromatin and chromosomes. So the idea then is that you would place this barrier so that when the replication fork hit it, it would cause that replication fork to stall. And then the prediction would be you would have more breakage points there because you're now having that tension between those two competing processes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, stalling the replication fork. And it's not just one protein bound to the DNA. We actually, these arrays are 256 tandem lac operator sequences. So we're able to get a lot of that repressor bound. And it hasn't actually been shown that this has been effective in anything other than yeast yet. So we're really looking forward to bringing it into metazoans and hopefully more eukaryotes thinking about these types of replication fork barriers.
Awesome. Early days tinkering with new tools.
Yeah.
So as you're finishing up your work in Dr. Golic's lab and you're moving on, what is next for you in your career?
I recently accepted a postdoc position in Dr. Brandon Cooper's lab up at the University of Montana, and I'm actually moving up there with my partner and our two Labradors in just a couple days. In Missoula, I'll continue working with Drosophila, and we'll study the naturally occurring bacterial endosymbiont Wolbachia. I'll use genetics and microscopy to study the biology of this host-microbe interaction. And we have some really fun ideas for projects that are in the works up there. So stay tuned for those.
That's awesome. So switching a little bit from chromosomes to more organismal health.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think I'm looking forward to kind of having a fresh start with learning some of the new literature and a whole new field, really. So
awesome. That's exciting. Congratulations on your postdoc.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, thank you again, Hunter, for your time. Congratulations on your recent defense and paper, and best of luck in your postdoc. The Genetics in Your Old podcast is produced by the Multimedia Subcommittee of the Early Career Leadership Program of the Genetics Society of America. We invite you to visit the Society's website for more information on how you can get involved with the genetics scientific community.